Scottish National Party, 13,209 votes. Lindsay Roy, Scottish Labour Party, 19,946 votes.
Yes, that was a noisy reception for Lindsay Roy, who won the Glenrothes by-election for Labour in the early hours of Friday morning. Hello, I'm Nick Watt and welcome to Politics Weekly. We'll be asking whether Gordon Brown has returned from the dead and can now entertain thoughts of winning the next general election, and what the SNP's failure means for Alex Salmond and his Scottish government. There was also a slightly more important election than the Glenrothes by-election earlier this week.
It's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
Yes, we're still recovering from the celebrations after Barack Obama made history this week when he was elected as the United States' first African-American president. We will ask what his election means for Britain's special relationship with the US and for Europe's relations with the United States. Joining me to discuss these matters is The Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and the head of politics at The Guardian, Will Woodward. Before I let the panel loose, we are going to hear from Lindsay Roy, the new Labour MP for Glenrothes. It seems he's quite keen on Gordon Brown.
With Gordon Brown, unemployment is less than half than it was under the Tories some time ago. With Gordon Brown, Britain is strong. With Gordon Brown, Labour has won here at Glenrothes and Central Fife.
That was Lindsay Roy. Well, we're now going to hear from Severin Carell, the Guardian's Scottish correspondent, who is toiling away in Glenrothes until the early hours of Friday morning.
I think it's immensely significant both for Gordon Brown but also for Scottish Labour. They were very much in the doldrums until the new Labour leadership was elected with Ian Gray shortly after Glasgow East. They were facing another humiliating defeat in the constituency. There were two things that happened. Firstly, Labour found a renewed sense of purpose and vigour inside the Scottish Party. But secondly, and crucially, Labour treated this campaign almost as if it was a general election campaign. The fact that the party leadership, the Prime Minister's reputation was at stake, I think, meant that they brought in far, far heavier weight guns and firepower than a by-election would normally have seen, particularly one in Scotland. And as a consequence, there was an intelligence and drive behind the Labour campaign that the SNP simply hadn't expected or prepared for. The SNP were outgunned on the ground and they were outthought.
And presumably this must be a particularly sweet moment for Gordon Brown. It's his neighbouring constituency and he campaigned there.
Indeed. I mean, it does vindicate his decision to come to Glenrothes twice, but most significantly, his wife, Sarah, campaigned here at least seven times, but probably more. The first time she appeared in Glenrothes, it was a bit of a disaster for the party. They had mishandled the media around that. There was a scrum with television cameras, a lot of journalists very annoyed and irritated by what happened, and that was embarrassing. But then Mrs. Brown was brought back to the constituency quietly, out of the media's gaze, and was used quite deliberately in key parts of the constituency, meeting voters in shopping centres, going around door to door. And Labour also claimed that they had a far, far sharper and smarter tactic about how to target particular wards, how to mobilise vote, and also how to work on a kind of double whammy. First, there was a very, very relentless and aggressive campaign attacking the SNP council and attacking the SNP government in Edinburgh. That was the negative campaigning that Nicola Sturgeon's complaining of today. But on the other hand, there was also positive campaigning, and the SNP are deliberately trying to ignore the consequences of that, because what Labour did do in something which must have cost them a fortune, every single household in Glenrothes about 10 days ago was sent a glossy 8-page mini magazine, which is almost like a Mills and Boone photo album of Lindsay Roy saying what a great guy this bloke was, talking about his RAF Second World War fighter pilot father, his World War mum being a nurse, all these things. And it was very, very, very deliberately calibrated.
Mills and Boone's by-election, we like that. Now tell me, Sev, how bad a setback is this for Alex Salmond, the SNP leader and First Minister? We thought he was absolutely perfect and could do no wrong.
A lot of people in Scotland think that Alex thought that too. Now, the problem with the SNP's position currently is, ironically, a bit of a mirror of Gordon Brown's. The difficulty that Alex Salmond has had is that a lot of his success and the buoyant position the party's had in the polls in the last 17 months since the by-election campaign, or the election campaign in Scotland last year, has suffered as a consequence in inverse proportion to Gordon Brown's bounce with the financial crisis. There's undoubtedly been a negative impact on the voters' belief in the SNP being able to deliver independence or deliver much greater rewards for Scotland. With the collapse of the Scottish banks, with the fact that Gordon Brown's been able to establish that the UK government appears to be much more able to rescue and defend Scottish banks than the Scottish government would do. So in a sense, this by-election defeat in the context of that is a serious setback for Salmond. And it does tend to establish that the very, very prolonged honeymoon the SNP have enjoyed since winning power in May 2007 is over. And Labour are claiming now that they are on a roll, the honeymoon is over, and they're now back going to be fighting Alex Salmond very, very hard. There are two key things which we have to watch. The first thing is opinion polls are starting to show for the first time after about a year and a half that the SNP's proportion of the vote in a Westminster general election is again lagging behind Labour. Now, for the last year, they've been able to claim they're ahead in a Westminster general election for the first time in their entire history. What we now have to look for is whether the opinion polls start showing the SNP's popular support in Scotland for a Scottish election pegging back to, and whether Labour really are genuinely in position of winning the 2011 Scottish elections, because up until now, it was widely thought the SNP would win again for Holyrood at the next election.
So, Polly, tell me, are the tectonic plates shifting? Is Gordon Brown being rewarded for his handling of the economic crisis?
I think huge relief for Labour. They'd gone out of their way to downplay this by-election right from the beginning, briefing saying, we haven't got a chance of winning, we're not going to win. Even in the last days when it looked as if they really were, or at least had a very good chance, they were still saying, no, we've had it. So they played it very, very well. Does it mean a major shift? Hard to know whether this is a local Scottish SNP factor or whether it's something bigger. I think it's probably a blend of both. I think the sense that Gordon Brown is a man back in control. He knows where he's going, he knows what he's doing, he's the right man for a crisis. He's back being Chancellor again, really, and that's perhaps what he's best at.
So, Will, Gordon Brown is back in control. Does this mean that he can think about winning the next general election? Does this mean that David Cameron's no longer walking on water?
Well, I think for the last couple of months, it's been fair to say that the argument has been going Brown's way. But this is probably the first time that's really translated into electoral achievement. And even in the polls have been moving a bit towards Labour over the last few weeks, but they haven't been that great. You're still looking at poll leads for the Conservatives in the high single figures. So it is encouraging because it's sort of what the media class, the chattering class, has been talking about, that Brown's on the way back, made real.
I mean, it's interesting, Polly, isn't it, for a government, particularly a government that has been losing a series of by-elections, to see its vote share increase. I mean, that takes us back to the early years of Tony Blair. That's pretty good. But do we need to be careful about reading too much into this across the UK? Because one of the reasons, perhaps, for Labour's success is that they can actually portray themselves as the opposition in Scotland. A bit more tricky in England to do that.
I think that's true. You know, the SNP is discovering what it's like to actually take on the responsibility of power and the opprobrium that always comes with it. People, you know, are angry with their governments for one reason or another. I also think the shock of Scotland's two great prestigious banks crashing out of the sky, and the fact that there's no way an SNP government in Holyrood could cope with that on their own, has brought a sort of jolt of reality, perhaps, into the SNP's offer. Suddenly people are thinking, well, actually, it's just as well we're not all on our own, and the idea of being Iceland is no longer nearly as attractive as it was.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it, Will, that Polly's saying there that what can the SNP government do when big banks are in trouble? That's a UK matter. What do you think this says about the way that Gordon Brown's sort of handling himself? I mean, he looked all at sea in the summer, didn't he? But now he's had his reshuffle, he's got Peter Mandelson back. He seems to, sort of, the wind seems to be behind him again now.
Yes, and now, I mean, there is a danger of sort of attributing magical powers to Lord Mandelson, who has caused problems as well as offered, you know, benefits to the cabinet in the last few weeks. But it does feel that he has got a spring in his step. I mean, you'll know better than me, but in the midst of the economic crisis, you suddenly found Brown laughing with reporters, joking in a way that he hadn't been able to do for quite some time. So his personality is meeting the moment in a way that it hasn't probably since the first couple of months of his premiership.
He's our top buddy down at Westminster. Polly, you mentioned there that obviously two Scottish banks are in trouble, which reminds us that we are in, to put it mildly, choppy economic times. This week we had a very aggressive interest rate cut on Thursday, taking them to 3%, the lowest since 1954 when Winston Churchill was Prime Minister. And also we've had a warning from the IMF that Britain's economy will contract more in a worse way than comparable economies. We're going to go into a bad recession, and this is not going to be great for Gordon Brown, is it?
It looks very grim. The question is whether Gordon Brown can become the master of the recession in the same sense that he's become master of global financial crisis. It's much harder, once we've stabilised banking, to look through a long winter, long spring, when more and more people are losing their jobs, when life really gets very hard indeed, and it looks as if it's going to be pretty brutal for an awful lot of people, to then be the person who doesn't take the blame. And I wonder whether, you know, right across the world, right across Europe, you're going to see governments being punished when people are really suffering. Because at the moment, you know, vast numbers of people aren't yet, but they will. And I think it's a question of whether Gordon Brown can capture the spirit of the times, if you like, can be the spirit of some sort of hope of seeing people through. This is not what he's good at. He has very little language. He's no Obama. He has very little vocabulary. He has very little means of communicating with emotional empathy with voters. That's not his political skill. His political skill is to be solid, reliable, and very good at economic matters in certain ways. And I just wonder whether he's going to be the man who can make people feel better in dark days. We wait to see.
And presumably his central line at the moment, which is that the United Kingdom is better placed to deal with the downturn than other economies, that doesn't seem to be borne out by the facts.
No, I'm afraid not. He's very slow to realise that he's about to be exposed with the things that he says. And when he says, you know, we'll be fine and we'll get through it all, and then when he says we're better off than others, each time this turns out to be absolutely not true. And he's always caught out saying these things when everybody already knows they're not true. And I'm not quite sure why he does that. He should be much quicker on his feet to say, yep, times are going to be hard, but this is what we're going to do. We're going to pull together. This is how I see our future. But he's not terribly good at that.
Well, we're now going to turn our attention across the Atlantic and assess what the election of Barack Obama means for Britain and Europe. We spoke to Ewan McCaskill, The Guardian's Washington bureau chief, who says that Barack Obama's victory will have a dramatic impact on world politics.
Well, one of the exciting things about this election is that, in comparison with the last 8 years, there's now finally going to be a president that believes in sort of cooperating with his allies rather than acting unilaterally, you know, with America as the world's policeman, rather than acting in concert with European and, you know, allies from the G7, and prepared to negotiate rather than just going off and doing your own thing, as George Bush was inclined to do.
To those who would tear the world down, we will defeat you. To those who seek peace and security, we support you. And to all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we proved once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals: democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
What's remarkable about having Barack Obama there after George Bush is it's a complete turnaround in Iraq. Barack Obama was totally opposed to the Iraq war from, you know, at the beginning. In 2002, he made this famous speech in Chicago, completely opposed to the war. And he is certainly one of the most liberal senators, probably one of the most liberal presidents we've ever had. But people who expect things to change quickly in Iraq are going to be disappointed. He said he's gradually sort of shifted his position, and the realities of being in office and the advice he gets from the military will see a change. He said he'd have all combat troops out of Iraq within 16 months. He's now added the caveat based on the advice of his generals and the Iraqi government. But there's another caveat. He says combat troops out. The US has 136,000 combat troops in Iraq. his definition of what constitutes combat, you could still have 80 to 100,000 American troops in Iraq at the end of that 16 months. And for most of the world, that doesn't constitute an American withdrawal.
Mr. Speaker, before listing my engagements, I'm sure the whole House will also wish to join me in sending our sincere congratulations to Senator Barack Obama on winning the presidency of the United States and writing a new chapter in history in doing so. The bonds that unite the United States and the UK are vital to our prosperity and security, and I know from talking to Senator Obama that he will be a true friend of Britain.
With regard to Britain, may Obama, there's some question about whether he would actually have gone to London on that trip. A lot of his advisors see the relationship with, say, Germany or China as much more important, or even India as much more important than Britain. Having said that, there will always be a special relationship between America and Britain, just because shared language and shared culture. Britain is the only country in the world that has access to American intelligence to the degree. So there is that closeness. So it doesn't matter who's the Prime Minister, who's President, that relationship is going to go on. Gordon Brown is naturally inclined towards the Democratic Party. He knows its history, he knows the senior players like Kerry. He spent his holidays in New England with Democratic senior figures in the Democratic Party. He will be happy that Obama's there. Although he had, for protocol reasons, he had to pretend to be neutral, he'll be glad that Obama's there. His politics are instinctively much the same as Obama's. Their worldview on Iraq, Afghanistan, Africa are very similar. So I think we could maybe see some quite radical changes in some parts of foreign policy. Although people have to be aware of expecting too much from Obama, this sort of messianic idea that he's going to resolve all the world's problems from Darfur to Iran just is not going to happen.
That was Ewan McCaskill. So, Polly, a new world beckons.
Well, I think he has a tremendous opportunity to repair a lot of the damage that George Bush has done to America's reputation around the world. He can open new doors. He can wipe out a lot of the past. But, you know, America's still America. America is still the only superpower, which gives it huge responsibilities, incredibly big boots wherever it goes. But I think he's got to move pretty fast within his first 100 days, those classic 100 days, to signal a great change of attitude. But, you know, geopolitics remain the same, and I don't see that there will be a vast shift. I mean, he's not going to suddenly stop being, you know, Israel's best friend, for instance.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it, Will? There's Polly saying that America will still be America. I mean, one area where I think Barack Obama may have a tough message for Europe is, hey, guys, I'm with you on Iraq, agreed with you on that one, but on Afghanistan, we've really got to get involved, and I want to see a much bigger involvement from Europe. So there may be tough messages.
Yes, that's right. And I think the world, insofar as you can speak for the world, is enormously impressed with his personality. I read a nice line in the LA Times this week about how he married ambitious goals with a cautious temperament. And I think that's an excellent way of describing his appeal. Trouble is, we don't know that much about the hard policy making, about how his decisions are going to play out. What sort of president is he going to be like? Is he going to be like Clinton was in his first year or two, where Clinton really sort of worried decisions to death and meant that the Democrats got off on the wrong foot on the Hill and in the wider world? I mean, it's all to play for.
Great. Well, look, thanks for that. Well, the election of Barack Obama dominated Prime Minister's questions in Britain this week. We asked Simon Hoggett, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, to describe the scenes for us.
Prime Minister's question time today really had only one topic, or rather two topics, but they were related. One was the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States, and the implication was that he had a lesson for all of us, and to the Tories it was a lesson that everybody wants change, that a failed government must make way for a new one, and for the Labour Party it was the message was that the left-wing party had won. It was a repudiation of everything right-wing and Conservative, began with Gordon Brown saying that he'd sent his congratulations to Barack Obama, a new chapter in American history. Tories, I thought, sat absolutely stolid and rigid and unimpressed by this. You'd think they'd have managed to scrape up a bit of enthusiasm for Senator Obama, but they didn't seem to.
And can I also join the Prime Minister in congratulating Barack Obama on his stunning victory in the American elections? I'd also like to pay tribute to John McCain, not least for the gracious way in which he conceded. This is a really important moment, to have gone from the horror of segregation to the election of a black president in just 4 decades is an incredible transformation, and it shows that the United States is a beacon of hope and opportunity and change. Yeah. I read this morning...
London Cameron said that he did join the Prime Minister in congratulating Barack Obama on his stunning victory. I think that the old Etonian feels he has a lot in common with the boy from the slums of Chicago, in that they're both young, full of change, and make rather good speeches off the top of their heads. There's certainly some kind of sense of identity there between Cameron. Even, I'm not at all sure, of course, that Barack Obama has even heard of David Cameron, but that may come later.
I read this morning that the Prime Minister has sent a message to the President-elect. Presumably it wasn't, "This is no time for a novice."
What I said was that serious times needed serious people. Once again, he's proved he's not serious.
Ben Cameron wondered aloud whether the Prime Minister had said in his message to Barack Obama, "This is no time for a novice." This, of course, was the phrase that Gordon Brown has used against David Cameron, and indeed against David Miliband, in his conference speech at the Labour Party conference 5 weeks ago. Huge cheers from the Tories for that, of course. Gordon Brown had his reply already. "No, I said that serious times needed serious people." Implication that he knew Barack Obama. He mentioned that a few times, but David Cameron, you're no Barack Obama.
That was Simon Hoggett from a noisy Guardian office in the House of Commons. Will, tell me, both parties are trying to exploit the Obama victory. The Tories say it's a vote for change. Labour says it's a vote for progressive policies. Who's the winner over here?
Temperamentally, in their sort of political manner, Cameron is closer to Obama than Brown, and I gather that their meeting in the summer went extraordinarily well, that there was a sort of personal chemistry between Cameron and Obama and their respective teams. But I think Brown won that exchange, actually, and I think that at the moment, I think the argument is on his side. I know the Tories cheer, but I can't believe Cameron used his question on it to remind the public at large of one of the Brown's best singers, "There Is No Time for a Novice." I mean, it might have seemed a good idea at the time, but I think it was a sort of disastrous move. More importantly, I think that the argument is on Brown's side, that the American and the British governments are broadly what you could call social democratic. They both believe in the power of big government. They both believe that government can be a benign as well as destructive force. And I think that helps Brown hugely.
Presumably, if David Cameron were sitting in our great studio here, he would say the reason why I used the novice line was that the election of Barack Obama absolutely proves my David Cameron response to the novice, which is it is judgment, not experience, that counts. And why did Barack Obama win that election? Not because he's experienced, it's because he's got great judgment. Hey, look at me, David Cameron.
But I think that the 2 years of campaigning that Obama has been through counts for experience. He fought off McCain. He fought off probably an even harder challenge from Hillary Clinton. And you cannot say that this is a veteran of political battles. Obama's huge impressive like that. I know Cameron has modernised the Conservative Party, but I don't think his experience thus far really matches up to Obama's.
So, Polly, Will thinks that on balance, Gordon Brown is the winner on this one.
I think he is, but it's up to him whether he seizes it, really. We're in the extraordinary position, an amazing somersault in history, where the American president is actually to the left of the British Labour Party. in power. We have Obama arriving in power saying he's going to sock it to the rich and he's going to spread the money around to the poorest. He's going to take 10 million of the lowest earners out of tax and make the rich pay. And what's more, 52% of the rich who will be taxed voted for him. Now, that ought to be a lesson at how to Labour about how much braver they can afford to be. I think it spreads a whole new aura right across Europe in terms of the left, really, of what's possible. Good heavens, if even an American president can do this thing, why is the European left so spineless? And in particular, the Labour Party. I don't know if Gordon Brown will seize that message. I suspect not. Mr. Cautious will remain Mr. Cautious.
Well, we say that Barack Obama is to the left of Gordon Brown. Surely he will only be to the left of Gordon Brown if he provides universal health care to everybody in the United States, regardless of your wealth. And in order to do that, you'd need to be taxing people in the United States at a far higher level than anything Barack Obama is suggesting, wouldn't you?
I imagine he'll do it slightly inch by inch, a certain amount in the first term, and then when he wins, I'm sure he'll win a second term, move it on again. But it's hardly the time to collect a huge amount of extra tax all round right now as you're heading into a recession. But in, 2-3 years' time, then I imagine that he'll be able to think again about whether, in fact, you could tax people more. And if you start off with a sort of fairly moderate scheme, I think you can expand it.
Right. Now, Will, let me just ask you, what do you think the election of Barack Obama means for the special relationship? There's been some speculation that because Gordon Brown is about 10 years older than Barack Obama, he's going to sort of see himself as his senior advisor, that he'll be sort of Harold Macmillan to John F. Kennedy. How do we see that one playing out?
Well, if that's the case, that would be a huge mistake. And Obama has, after all, just won an election, which is something that Brown cannot claim to have done.
He won the Glenn Rothers by-election. They're talking of nothing else in the transitional team.
Well, there we are. You win. That trumps all. A few thousand people changed their votes in Scotland, and that makes Brown an election winner. No, I think that would be a mistake. I thought Ewan was very interesting in that clip about the special relationship, in that I suppose Ewan was saying that there are more interesting relationships which Obama needs to develop, particularly in the Far East, but that the special relationship is enduring enough for Britain to still have a voice and still be a player, even with a Democrat administration. I mean, this goes back to something we were talking about earlier, but I do think that Brown particularly has had to pretend to like George Bush. I think Tony Blair probably did genuinely like George Bush, but Brown had to pretend to. And I think Brown will have no such worries about seeking friendship with Obama. I think he admires him and, as Ewan says, shares a lot of his views.
And he'll want some of the magic to sort of rub off on him. I mean, that's interesting, Polly, isn't it? Both Ewan and Will are saying that Barack Obama will not necessarily instinctively be looking to Britain, he'll look to Germany, look to India. Julian Glover, when he was here last week, said, you shouldn't forget where Barack Obama comes from. He was brought up in Hawaii. He was brought up in Indonesia. He will be looking to the Pacific Rim even before he looks to Europe.
I think, on the other hand, his sort of intellectual roots are fairly European in terms of, he's one of the best educated and cleverest presidents we've had in a long time. But I think, the British delusion about the special relationship is always painful to watch. It's agonisingly embarrassing. We have this special relationship, desperate, now, trying to cling to the coattails. It would be so much more dignified just to step back. We know it exists because of language and because of history, but not to overplay it and to talk more about Europe and Europe's role with America. But we will never do that. We have this imaginary bridge, a kind of rainbow across the Atlantic that we think is a special relationship. One of the previous American ambassadors recently wrote an extremely humiliating and funny book about Britain's delusion about the special relationship, Ray Seitz. And I wish we could just cool it a bit and be more European in our approach.
As Chris Mayer, the former British ambassador to Washington, said, he said the problem with Tony Blair's great bridge across the Atlantic is it can also collapse, as indeed it did. So do you think, Polly, we have to accept the fact that Nicolas Sarkozy and his incredibly glamorous wife, Carla Bruni, they may beat Gordon and Sarah to the Obama White House?
Oh, the mad scramble for who can get in the door first. Oh, dear me. You know, or Angela Merkel, it's always been the case that Germany has been a more important relationship. We've deluded ourselves. I mean, in this country, we report so badly what goes on in Europe that we never report about other major European countries' relationship with America. It always, you know, the British are only ever shown our relationship with America, which is often thin. Even when we, you know, ruined ourselves by going to America's war, it remains the case that, you know, we've had very little gratitude even for that.
So Angela and Nicola, they'll be there before us. Thank you for that. That's it from this week's edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee and the head of politics at the Guardian, Will Woodward. Politics Weekly was produced by Ben Green. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week. Until then, goodbye.